aficionados they are today. In fact, the self-described city boys who hail from urban Scotland didn't develop a taste for the great outdoors until 13 years ago, when they moved to Canada and started spending time in Ontario's cottage country. One trip in particular to a lakeside log cabin where bears, moose, and deer wandered right up to their doorstep was a turning point for the interior design duo. "It totally blew our minds," McAllister says, "and we immediately started exploring the possibility of creating our own rustic retreat." So far, the seasoned cabin renovators have presided over 6 of their own pastoral projects, made a television series documenting their rural design adventures, and hosted another series called Great Escapes with Colin and Justin, in which they visited other people's inviting country abodes. Now the design pros have put their passion into book form with the release of Escapology, Modern Cabins, Cottages, and Retreats. The 256-page tome is equal parts inspiring and informative, featuring an eclectic selection of 24 escapes spanning 9 countries. In addition to striking images of enviable getaways, including a sprawling mountain lodge in Montana, a tiny treehouse in Ontario, and a contemporary cabin in South Africa, the book offers expert tips on everything from going off the grid to choosing appropriately durable furnishings. "Our dream was that readers could marvel at the homes but find heaps of takeaway information too," McAllister says. While the featured homes are wonderfully diverse in size, style, location, and budget, they all have one thing in common: their respect for the surrounding landscape. As Colin and Justin write in Escapology, "When it comes to complementing a home's natural setting, it's all about fitting in and not taking over." From a rural events standpoint, the book couldn't have come at a better time. With a global pandemic forcing us to stay home more than ever, people are reevaluating what they need from both their primary homes and vacation properties. "We've all been stuck indoors for months this year," Ryan says. "This has provided an opportunity for people everywhere to look at their homes under the microscope. This, in turn, has led to an upturn in people looking to renovate and create homes that are joyous, relaxing, cosseting, and memorable." With Escapology, homeowners and prospective homeowners alike just might find some much-needed motivation, either to embark on a long-fantasized-about renovation project, or, like the authors themselves did all those years ago, seek out their own dream retreat in the country. Either way, Ryan has some advice to keep in mind. "The escapist home can be created anywhere," he says. "It's all about creating spaces that are functional, beautiful, and, above all, personal." House of Rodeo. Look inside a home steeped in cowboy history. By Emily C. Laskowski. Framed on a rugged wood-planked wall of Carla Harrison's sprawling Oklahoma ranch, you'll find a number 31 bib from the 1967 National Finals Rodeo. It's one of 8 framed bibs she has, each worn between 1959 and 1969, as the NFR by rodeo legend Freckles Brown, her husband's grandfather. In 1967, wearing that number 31 on his back, Brown, then 46, and already a world champion bull rider, made history when he topped the unrideable bull Tornado in front of a packed Oklahoma City arena on the NFR's opening night. For Harrison, displaying Brown's bibs along with hundreds more, at least, rodeo mementos, isn't just about history, it's about family. When she and her husband John Harrison, himself a professional Rodeo Cowboys Association member, an award-winning rodeo clown and barrel man, started planning their dream house on his family's generations-old property. It needed to embody their welcoming family-style way of life. We built this big house because we have a lot of rodeo friends that are passing through, Carla Harrison says. So it is 8 bedrooms, and I think I filled it to the max occupancy 4 or 5 times in the 2 years we've had it. It's always people passing through, whether it's 1 or 2 rooms that are occupied with friends or family. And that's the reason why we built it. We love having people over and entertaining and just enjoying the fellowship and camaraderie of others. It took 2 years to construct the home itself, a labor of love, Harrison says, which features antiques and reclaimed furnishings from all over the country. But what's showcased inside has been a work in progress for nearly a decade. We started collecting from the get-go, she explains. We just started holding on to pieces that we loved. And I'm not joking. I've saved every issue of Cowboys and Indians I ever got. In addition to valuable pieces of rodeo history, like saddles belonging to Brown, Harrison has gone to great lengths to preserve personal belongings that have been passed down through generations. Her husband's great-great-grandfather's rifle hangs above the front door. The crib Brown made for his only daughter, Donna, which has been used by all of Harrison's children, now occupies one of the guest rooms. The mantles, those were hewn from the first Christmas tree John's grandparents planted on the property, and repurposed only after an ice storm forced them to be cut down. Harrison even discovered how to reprint an illustration made by her father, a cowboy cartoonist, on the vegetable sink in her kitchen. I'm surrounded by memories, Harrison says, and that is fine with her. It helps the whole family remain connected to the loved ones who have influenced them so dearly. And yet, just as important are the memories and stories they're making now, with the friends and family that are always passing through. My favorite part of my house is when it's full of friends and family, Harrison says. My house never feels better, more alive. I don't feel more blessed than when I'm surrounded by people that I love to be around. Josh Turner's Country Cottage. When the hitmaker wants to lay low and write songs, he doesn't have far to go. By Hunter Hawk. It's been nearly 20 years since South Carolina native Josh Turner made his Grand Ole Opry debut to a fervent standing ovation. He was asked by the crowd that night to do an encore of the song he'd performed, a haunting redemption ode called Long Black Train that later introduced the wider world to his strikingly low baritone vocals and a songwriting voice that went even deeper. 8 studio albums and many hit songs and live shows later, Turner has built quite a full life with his wife Jennifer and their 4 sons. He's enjoying the fruits of his prolific musical efforts on their land south of Nashville, but still active and wildly popular in country music. A member of the Grand Ole Opry since his induction in 2007, Turner has paid homage to musical heroes on his latest record, Country State of Mind, applying his own deeper than the holler range to classics made famous by Randy Travis, Vern Gosden, Hank Williams, and more. The cover's album didn't just root from a desire to honor past legends, but also out of logistical necessity for the 43-year-old star. Recording the classics seemed like a good idea during a time when he couldn't find the space to sit down and write original material. Since 2012, Turner has retreated to a peaceful writer's cottage on his property whenever he needed a creative respite. No phones, no internet, no TV, Turner says. It's just a place where you can go and there's peace and quiet and you can write and be creative and think, not just be interrupted or distracted. Many of his hits have been written in that space. A two-story, 1,750-square-foot model originated by Southland Log Homes. But it stopped being his writer's retreat for a little more than a year when his entire family moved into the space while their home was being remodeled and renovated. I like for things to be kind of in order over there, which made us living in it really hard because I had to let all of them go with four boys, Turner says. I can't complain because we were still able to live on our property, oversee the rebuilding project of our house, and get all that done. In the midst of the renovations and other projects, I went about 2 years without really having a formal sit-down songwriting session. But it is good to have it back in a condition to where I can write in it and be creative again. Turner says he's back in full songwriting swing in the cottage as he continues to celebrate and tour on the release of Country State of Mind. He should have plenty to inspire new lyrics considering the year we've all been through. And his cottage is more important than ever as a way to gain some perspective. He's surrounded in the structure's two-story great room by a cozy fireplace, personal mementos, quirky down-home decor items, and a vinyl collection full of the artists he says made him who he is. Turner feels much more like a handyman these days as well, having presided over many changes to his family's property over the years. He admits it's occasionally been a trial by fire. I've gotten good at different electrical stuff and plumbing stuff. I replaced an exhaust fan in our bedroom that I'm about lost my religion over. Country stars, they're just like us. Monumental spirit. Native American veterans are finally getting some long overdue recognition with a new national memorial in Washington, D.C. by Chuck Thompson. Considering the extraordinary history behind the new National Native American Veterans Memorial, the story of the hawk that consecrated its location on National Mall doesn't seem so far-fetched. Shortly after the design was selected in 2018, the memorial's designer, Harvey Pratt, a Cheyenne Arapaho Sioux artist from Oklahoma, traveled to Washington, D.C. to join a committee on the site where the new landmark would be constructed. We were giving a presentation at the final site. About 30 of us were standing there, and a hawk flies out of the southwest and it lands right on the spot we chose and starts hopping around, Pratt recalls. I said, "Look, he's dancing." Then he flew up in a tree and sat there the whole hour we were there. He came out of the southwest. That's the direction where the Creator lives. My oldest brother and grandfather's name was Hawk. My ancestors came there to approve what we've done. More auspicious yet, the visitation has proved no coincidence. Pratt's hawk has since been observed frequently perching on a tree near the memorial, and a smaller hawk has begun hanging out on one of the armatures of the time-lapse camera system installed atop the system to document the construction of the memorial. You could hardly ask for more fitting guardians to watch over the site as it awaits its official introduction to the country. The memorial's unveiling and dedication had been planned for Veterans Day, November 11, 2020, in the nation's capital. Though the pandemic has put those plans and the Native Veterans Procession on hold for now, the spirit of the long-belated recognition has not diminished. Located on the grounds of the National Museum of the American Indian, the monument is an elevated stainless steel circle balanced on an intricately carved stone drum with water flowing across the surface of the drum. The design incorporates elements of earth, water, fire, and air. Ripples emanating from the water feature represent vibrations from the drum, calling people from around the nation. This is not a monument people will stand back and look at, but one they will gather within, says Rebecca Head Troutman, the museum project curator for the memorial. National recognition of Native American military veterans has been a long time coming. Legislation authorizing the memorial's construction passed in 1994. Sponsor Senator John McCain of Arizona and co-sponsors Daniel Akaka of Hawaii and Ben Nighthorse Campbell of Colorado, all military veterans, were among its initial sponsors in the U.S. Senate. But the memorial's legacy dates to the 1700s and honors all Native American men, women, and military families who have fought and sacrificed in every major military conflict in American history. When the memorial is unveiled, the country will recognize, for the first time on a national scale, the enduring and distinguished service of Native Americans in every branch of the U.S. Armed Forces, according to the museum. This memorial carries the heavy responsibility of respectfully acknowledging American, Indian, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian veterans, reminding all Americans of our national obligation to honor this inspired legacy. Widespread awareness of Native American participation in the U.S. military tends to start and stop with World War II. For good reasons, the famed Navajo code talkers, who radioed secret battlefield messages in a coded version of their language that remained indecipherable to enemy codebreakers, have been widely celebrated. Pima Indian Marine Ira Hayes, who helped raise the Stars and Stripes over Iwo Jima in an event captured in the famous Joe Rosenthal photograph, lives on in The Ballad of Ira Hayes, made famous by Johnny Cash and the 2006 film Flags of Our Fathers. Fans of the World War II comic book Sergeant Rock may recall Little Sure Shot, the Apache guide and sharpshooter who served as one of the pillars of the Combat Habit Joes of the fictional Easy Company. Yet starting with the Revolutionary War, when indigenous soldiers, largely of the Iroquois Confederacy, fought on both American and British sides, Native Americans have fought as part of the American military. They battled on both sides of the Civil War. They fought against, but also alongside, U.S. troops in the Indian Wars. They took part in operations in Cuba, the Philippines, and the Boxer Rebellion in China. But particularly since World War I, when Choctaw, Comanche, Cheyenne, Osage, and Uinta Sioux were used as the first Native American radio code talkers, they've consistently served at higher rates per capita than any other ethnic group. Although most Indians in 1970 were not subject to the draft because they were not U.S. citizens, they enlisted in astonishing numbers, wrote Herman Viola about World War I soldiers in his book Warriors in Uniform. Indian troops often volunteered for or were used as advance scouts among the most dangerous positions in combat. About 5% of Native American troops were killed or injured in the Great War, compared with a 1% casualty rate for the entire American Expeditionary Force. They established a remarkable record of patriotism and selflessness during a conflict that they had no readily apparent reason to join or recognize. Nevertheless, they contributed to the victory beyond their tribal numbers or resources. That outsized contribution has never abated. Some Navajos were so enthusiastic to join World War II, they showed up at induction centers toting their own rifles and shotguns. As they had done to Germany in World War I, the Iroquois Confederacy, or Six Nations, declared war on the Axis powers in 1942. That same year, at least 99% of all eligible Native American males had registered for the draft. Had all eligible American males enlisted in the same proportion as tribal people, there would have been no need for the Selective Service System. An estimated 10,000 Native Americans served in the Korean War, Another 42,000 were in the military in the Vietnam War. Today, some 31,000 serve on active duty, reserve, and National Guard. Many have fought, died, or been injured in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other battlefields around the world. About 133,000 veterans identify as American Indian, Alaska Native, or Native Hawaiian. Of these, 11.7% are women, compared with 8.4% of all other ethnicities. Native American soldiers have also established a reputation as some of the most fierce and poised fighters in the field. A Crow soldier named Walks Over Ice related a story to Viola about a new recruit during the Vietnam War who asked to be transferred to his platoon. "My dad was in World War II, and he said, 'If you ever get into combat, find an Indian and he'll keep you alive. So I want to be with you,' explained the recruit. Walk Over Ice directed the new soldier to his brother, who was already serving in the recruit's platoon. "My brother kept him alive," Walks Over Ice said. Such a long and complex legacy poses a unique challenge for the 120 entrants who formally submitted designs to the memorial's blind juried competition. There's this idea of a monolithic Native American culture, which of course doesn't exist, Trotman says, noting that there are more than 500 federally recognized tribes in the United States. It was important the memorial design be inclusive of all these traditions. Prior to the competition, museum staff worked with an advisory committee of Native Americans to hold 35 consultations across the country, gathering input from tribal communities on themes and ideas the memorial should address. Initially, Harvey Pratt wasn't interested in submitting a design. A friend had invited him to one of those public meetings in Shawnee, Oklahoma, but Pratt fended off his friend's encouragement to submit an entry. "Oh no, there's going to be people coming from all over the damn place. Those are big fans with large staffs competing for that," he told the friend. "I'd just be wasting my time." Deep down, Pratt was intrigued. An artist since grade school in the 1950s, when a teacher encouraged his talent for paying for art supplies out of his own pocket, Pratt has always shown an ability to blend multicultural influences into his singular artistic vision. He sold his first painting as a high school student at St. Patrick's Indian Mission School in Anadarko, Oklahoma, a crucifixion scene in which all of the figures were Indians, with war bonnets, feathers, and lances. It was so good that the priests could hardly complain of heresy. One helped him sell it for $90. In those days, $90 was 2 weeks' pay for a lot of people, Pratt says. "Man, the light bulbs went off for me when that happened." Pratt went on to a distinguished 50-year career in law enforcement. From 1972 to 2017, he was with the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation as a narcotics investigator, assistant director, interim director, and internationally sought-after police forensics artist. Throughout his career, suspect drawings, skull reconstructions, age progressions, and soft tissue post-mortem renderings he drew based on victim and witness descriptions helped lead to the arrest of murderers, rapists, and other criminals, including the Green River Killer, BTK Killer, and I-5 Killer. All the while, he worked on the side as a commercial artist and sold his work in galleries. After his friend dragged him into a second memorial planning meeting, this one in Oklahoma City, Pratt said, "Let me dream on it." Not long after, he sat down at home with a yellow legal pad and began sketching. The basic design flowed quickly like an ethereal inspiration. "The first time I saw Harvey's sketches, I knew they were special," said his wife Gina. "I looked at them and thought, 'You did it.' It left me speechless for a short time. It was very profound." Pratt's son, also an artist, encouraged him to take the designed Oklahoma City's skyline link to be animated. I said, "I don't think I can afford you guys," Pratt said. They said, "Don't worry about it. We believe in what you're doing. We want to support you." As the project picked up steam, he partnered with Oklahoma City Butzer Architects and Urbanism. The veteran team there gave physical shape to Pratt's design, influencing choices of concrete, steel, stone, lighting, pathways, and other construction details. "They made it even better than what it was," Pratt says. What makes Pratt's winning design all the more astonishing is that in a competition that drew entries from around the world, the blind jury selected the work not only as of a Native American. Who would have thought a Cheyenne Arapaho Sioux guy would win this thing? Pratt says, but of a military veteran. Inspired by the warrior tradition of his community and a charismatic uncle who fought in World War II in Korea, Pratt joined the U.S. Marines shortly after becoming disenchanted with college art classes following his high school graduation. He was sent to Vietnam in 1963 as part of a reconnaissance unit whose job was to recover downed helicopter pilots and protect the U.S. airbase at Da Nang. "I designed our platoon guidon," he says. "It was called Hughes Hellions. Our lieutenant's name was Edward Hughes. He was killed in Vietnam." Pratt's experience in that painful conflict, he believes he was one of the first Native Americans sent to Vietnam, informs the design of the memorial, which, among other things, is intended as a place of peace and remembrance. One thing we heard over and over again in the community consultations was a wish for the experience of visiting the memorial to be a healing and contemplative one. Something that surprised us was a strong preference expressed for the memorial to be located in a quieter place, a contemplative and reflective place, rather than one of the prominent visible places, such as right on Independence Avenue. In a setting so serene, even a hawk can relax for an hour, the memorial will surely become a spiritual beacon. But with its four lances that rise around the drum, it also embodies the unconquerable spirit that provides the answer to one of the questions most frequently asked of all Native American service members. Why are a people who have been so historically mistreated by the American government so willing to take up arms on behalf of that government? The answer lies in the warrior culture that remains pervasive across Native American communities. "Ours was a race of fighting men. War was our occupation," a Native American World War I soldier named James Kawakakla explained in answer to the question about a war now more than a century gone. The Memorial Committee found the same commitment to serving and protecting everywhere it consulted with Native American communities. There's a reason powwows traditionally begin with a presentation of flags by a color guard. No figure drove the point home more powerfully than a veteran who stood at a meeting hosted by the Southern Ute Indian tribe in Ignacio, Colorado. "Our great-great-grandparents' bones are in this land that we live on, so we still think of it as our own. We're willing to put forth our lives to keep enemies away." The museum will mark the memorial's completion day with a virtual ceremony that acknowledges the milestone and honors the service and sacrifice of Native Americans and their families. The dedication and the procession will be rescheduled when it's safe for large groups to gather again. Here's an adventure article entitled "Sky King." When Texas native Kirby Chambliss isn't at home on his Flying Crown Ranch in Arizona, the world champion aerobatic and air race pilot is cowboying it up and upside down in the wild blue yonder. By Tony Reagan. Kirby Chambliss does most of his flying with his feet on the ground. Back when the native Texan was a world champion pilot in the Red Bull Air Race, before the series abruptly folded after the 2019 season, Chambliss believed that each race was won or lost long before takeoff. Now that he's back to aerobatics full-time, back to swooping and diving and pushing planes to their limits above the grandstands full of awestruck air show goers, Chambliss, 61, still believes it's all in his head. I try to visualize every aspect, every sequence, every fraction of a second, he says. I want to visualize from the ground what it's going to look like for those people in the stands. That's what really has helped me to win. For instance, before a 2018 race at Texas Motor Speedway in Fort Worth, at the back of the Team Chambliss hangar, one of Chambliss's tech-savvy crew members had set up a state-of-the-art flight simulator that could virtually take pilot Chambliss through every twist and turn of the race course and mimic the power, speed, and agility of Chambliss's Edge 450 V3 aerobatic aircraft. It could replicate the conditions and pressures he'd put the plane through on his runs. The program could even account for the wind, but Chambliss wasn't having any of it. The simulator is a pinball machine, he said, loud enough so his technicians could hear. I'm open to anything. I know I can't fly by the seat of my pants anymore. I'll listen to the guys, but I don't always follow what they say. He'd listen to about 10% of what we say, said Paulo Escold, the team tactician, after overhearing. Paulo has spent hours poring over data, trying to translate instrument and computer readings into applicable advice for Chambliss to take up in the air. Actually, it's more like 5%. I can't follow them blindly, Chambliss said. If they put the wrong numbers in, I'll be flying the wrong way. Instead, Chambliss walked past the simulator over to a crude model of the race course he had laid out himself in the corner of the hangar, using cans of Red Bull to represent the 82-foot inflatable pylons that create the gates he'd fly between and around on the slalom-like course. With his hand laid palm down on his imaginary plane, Chambliss instead walked through his flight path, drawing on decades of experience and the rough calculations of his mind. Chambliss calibrated that mental simulator through years spent soaring through wide-open skies of southeast Texas. Born in Corpus Christi, Chambliss has been drawn to the skies since he can remember. His dad, a private pilot, led a pajama-clad Chambliss tag along in the ride seat of a Cessna when he was just 5. Chambliss helped his father build his own plane out of sheet metal before he was a teenager, and he had a job cleaning restrooms and fueling aircraft at a small regional airport all through high school. When Chambliss got his first gig behind the controls of a corporate jet at age 21, his bosses told him he should take some remedial courses in aerobatics in case of an emergency. They told me, "What happens if the jet ends up upside down?" Chambliss said. When the young pilot first experienced the thrill of rolls, spins, and dives of aerobatics, he was hooked. From that moment on, I could care less about flying straight up. Now I'm flying in 3D. The only limit is my imagination. After 5 years of imagination and work flying for Southwest Airlines, where at age 24 he became the company's youngest ever pilot, Chambliss bought his own aerobatic plane, a Pitts special biplane, in 1983. By 1997, he was a member of the U.S. National Aerobatic Team. He was eventually named team captain and went on to win 5 national championships and 13 medals at the World Championships, including the 2000 men's freestyle world title. In 2003, Peter Bisigni a Hungarian-born fellow aerobatics world champion, contacted Chambliss about joining the new Red Bull Air Race, a series of races in which the globe's top pilots would steer their monoplanes through daunting courses of gates, turns, and chicanes set up all over Europe, Asia, Australia, and North and South America, trying to best each other's times. The high speeds and stunts at low altitudes appealed to the daredevil in Chambliss. "We used to drag our wings in the dirt," he said. "It was a lot of fun." Chambliss finished on the podium in each of the first four seasons, including two series championships. But as the sport grew in popularity, safety became more of an issue. More rules were added, including a floor of no less than 30 feet above the ground. Still, Chambliss remained competitive, finishing fourth as recently as 2017. In the process, between the air race and the aerobatics, Chambliss had logged more than 27,000 hours in the air, more than twice the total of most of his competitors in the adjacent hangars at Texas Motor Speedway that day. "We have a saying about the difference between 10,000 hours and 5,000, he says. "It just means you've seen it twice." The veteran might have made light of his tenure in the cockpit, but he and his crew knew that vast experience would be an asset against competitors half his age who might have relied too much on the technology and less on the feel of the stick in hand. Team Chambliss crew chief Jason Rissup said that they often prayed for wind and rain. "We do well in crazy weather," Rissup said. "He can adapt on the fly. No one drives the edge better than him." Team Chambliss took third place that day to the delight of the crowd in his home state, and he finished sixth for the season. The next year, which turned out to be the Red Bull Ace race's last, he took second in the series finale in Chiba, Japan. The only Red Bull Air Racer to compete in every season, he finished his Red Bull Air Race career with two championships, 2004 and 2006, and third on the all-time wins list with 10. When the Globetrotting series folded, Chambliss returned to the American West, where he now gets to spend most of his time. He owns the Flying Crown Ranch in Arizona, where he lives with his pilot wife, Kelly, and daughter, Carly. With no outlet for his competitive edge, he instead expresses himself through the aerobatics he performs at air shows all over the world. This is Chambliss as artist, the plane his brush, the sky his canvas. He wants to paint the audience a picture that they've never seen before, moves that even Chambliss has only seen in his own mind. "If I can leave a fan saying, 'I've never seen a plane do that before,' that means everything to me," Chambliss says. "The only limitation is my imagination." Superior Concrete. Secure your surroundings with beauty of design, strength of construction, and decades of longevity. By Lindsay Welchel. Though he's a longtime businessman, you're just as likely to find Todd Sternfeld outdoors working on the ranch he bought and refurbished outside of Dallas. He may be on his tractor or busy perfecting his fields with picturesque landscaping. But unlike the work surely being done on other ranches, you won't find Sternfeld mending fences. That's because the perfectly aligned fence found on Sternfeld's ranch might appear to be constructed of a high-quality wood, but is, in fact, not wood at all. You see, almost 40 years ago, Sternfeld had an idea. What if he could have the look of a beautiful wood fence with the durability of concrete? And thus, Superior Concrete Products was born. It's nearly four decades of business, the company's creations have become eye-catching fixtures in a wide variety of places, from ranches to schools, golf courses to city parks. We've done a lot of stuff with the product that people have never seen before. I love creating and I love dealing with people that have those ranches and those properties they want to improve. Sternfeld grew up in California, enjoying working with his hands. After high school, he got involved in a landscaping company and was introduced to the precast concrete business. But the existing products were just basic concrete. They had no color and came with only one side of texture. It felt incomplete to Sternfeld, who pioneered a new way of molding the concrete to achieve a double-sided texture. At first, Superior Concrete Products had a solid concrete fence that looked like wood on both sides. This initial design kick-started an extensive line of products that have been developed over the years and even include integrated colors mixed right into the concrete, so you'll never have to paint or repair your fences or buildings again. Sternfeld exhibited his work at the International Builders Show in Houston in 1983. People loved it. It really had a great response because they use so much wood here in Texas, Sternfeld says. By the time the show moved to Dallas in 1985, Sternfeld had embraced the cowboy culture and Western heritage he had always loved as a kid growing up. It wasn't long before he knew he had to pack up his bags and business and move to the Lone Star State. We set up initially on a small, ready-mix facility, and I went out and started to call on builders and developers, municipalities, architects, engineers and landscape architects, and introduced them to the product. Since then, the company has grown exponentially, extending the product line to include its popular rail fencing and brick, stucco, and stone textures. Building a career was ingrained early in Sternfeld's childhood, watching his grandfathers in business. One came to the United States from Poland in 1920 and did real estate property management, and the other was in the tool business, selling to farmers across California's agricultural industry. It was Sternfeld's father who taught him that his word was his honor, and he instilled in him the importance of going above and beyond to take care of the customer. Sternfeld certainly got his work ethic from his father, too. The elder Sternfeld had been a VP national sales manager for the successful clothing brand Kennington Limited. After his retirement, he continued working with his son at Superior Concrete Products before passing away recently at age 84. Sternfeld stands behind his products, ensuring quality by handling everything in-house. The company manufactures the products and even has engineers on staff who factor in each job's specific conditions, such as height, soil, and wind. We have become kind of a design-build company where we sell, design, and engineer, manufacture, and install. That way we have a pretty good control over the process, Sternfeld says, citing the factory's certification by the National Precast Concrete Association. Beyond fenced products, Sternfeld has utilized his innovative methods in concrete to create a host of structures, from footbridges, barns, and other buildings, to award-winning tiny houses, effectively turning concrete into a work of art. One thing that's always kept me motivated and engaged is I can never stop creating. I don't think I'll ever be able to do all the things I want in a lifetime, because you can always continue to create. It's that same love of turning something unexpected into a thing of beauty that inspired Sternfeld to purchase and completely overhaul the ranch he now enjoys with his loving wife and daughters who've supported his vision. The ranch was like an overgrown canvas that I had to clean up and see what I had. I've just been chiseling away at it, seeing the vision that I've been able to create from nothing to what it is now, not only with the ranch, but with the business as well, just continues to drive me. One of Sternfeld's many satisfied customers shares the same sentiment about his own ranch. It was basically a sticker patch. It had an old barbed wire fence down that was falling down, says Jerry Nichols of Blue Sky Ranch, which he set out to transform a few years ago. "It's a golf course now, basically," he says proudly. When it came time to fence the property's half mile of road frontage, Nichols wanted something nice, but was shocked at the quote he got for pipe fencing. I was like, "Wait a minute. There's maintenance on this fence," he says, laughing. "You're going to have to sand it. The wells are going to give way. You're going to have to keep painting at it." Nichols had past experience with other fences. Vinyl, he felt, mildewed and wasn't sturdy. Wood boards warped and popped out of place. Then Nichols saw an ad in this very magazine that introduced him to Superior Concrete Products. What does he think of his concrete rail fencing? It's a showstopper. People park in the driveway and walk along looking at the fence. Todd's organization, all I can say is they're the first class. It's the only way to go. That's fulfilling feedback to Sternfeld. I love being able to impact other people's lives with our product because it makes their lives easier. The product has virtually no maintenance. I've got fences I put up in 30-plus years ago that are still doing fine today. And it's safe to say that same longevity mirrors a well-run business, too.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the coronavirus update at 1.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Barney and Our New Neighbor, Nonfiction First Place by Leonard Tuchiner. My 45-pound little beige dog has no proclivities or intentions towards the profession of guide dog. He has the looks and strength of a sled dog with the dogged stubbornness that gets him where he wants to go, even if he has to take his leash-wielding provider with him. Picture a porch deck perched outside my sliding glass door. Picture a number of bird feeders and suet baskets hanging from metal arms protruding from the wooden sliding. These feeders dangle at eye level, 2 feet from said window. One more important aspect is that the porch is 2 stories up from the ground, from which 2 flights of stairs ascend as access to and from my backyard. Now imagine this tranquil scene in early spring at 2 a.m. when my hibernating bears and reasonable people are sleeping snug in their dens, which is exactly what Diane and I were doing when Barney the dog went ape. I should mention here that his sleeping mat is on the indoor side of the glass door. Suddenly, I became aware of a cacophony of thuds against the sliding glass door, and enough growls and barks to wake the dead. Reluctantly awake, I waited for Diane to investigate. It seemed reasonable to me that she should be the one to go downstairs to see what in the world is going on, since she is a much better seer than I am. But she didn't move. With a few half-mutter expletives and whines, I untangled myself from my cloying blankets and felt my way to the dresser to consult my talking watch. 2 a.m. As I bumbled my way down the upper bedroom stairs, my mind slogged back to the last time Barney went into conniptions. The cause then was a raccoon trying to mooch off of the bird feeders. I doubted that I would be able to see a raccoon on the porch, but maybe I could scare it away by banging on the glass door. On second thought, Barney was already doing that, not to mention his barrage of vocalizations. Well, maybe I could calm the dog down and go back to sleep. I should be so lucky. On my way to the ruckus, I pass Chloe's couch, which is against the wall opposite the glass door. I notice Chloe, our foxhound terrier mix, seated in her usual sleeping place. I wondered why she wasn't joining in the fracas. She seemed to be telling me, "I don't want any part of this." That was strange. She had enjoyed joining Barney in chasing away the raccoon of the previous year. Barney was behind the door curtains, getting in more barks per minute than I would have thought possible. He was not just standing there, he was jumping up and down, throwing himself against the door and pawing away at the glass, as though he was trying to dig his way out. I drew back the curtains and switched on the porch lights. I keep denying that I'm mostly blind, and peer into the eternal, impenetrable fog. I couldn't see a thing. I tried to calm the dog down before he had a heart attack. It was like trying to stem the rush of a cataract. Then I tried yelling and threatening him to get him to stop his infernal barking. He briefly stopped jumping, but the barking and growling continued unabated. Instead, he started shaking like a car going 90 on unbalanced tires. Feeling helpless, I retreated back upstairs to the bedroom, refusing to accept Diane's act as a peacefully sleeping bystander. I said, "I can't stop him. I think we need to go downstairs and see what's going on." She threw the covers off in an anger, like it was my fault or something. I sat on the bed wondering if I could get away with staying upstairs. I didn't have to wonder long. The next thing I heard was, "Oh my God, what is it?" I called down. "A big bear." That got me back downstairs in a hurry. "He's pulled down the bird feeders and made off with the suet cage," she said. "Where is he now?" "He's on the second landing, waiting to come back up and get the feeders. He's taller than I am." Chloe came to the door to protect me, and he backed off. Note, Diane is 5'7". Chloe is her dog, and Chloe will do anything to protect her, even if she has the sense not to challenge a black bear. She took another look out the window. "He's gone," she said. I grabbed my samurai sword, which I keep handy in the living room, and went to the door. "What are you doing?" she demanded. "I'm going to make sure he stays away." "Are you effing crazy? He'll kill you." "Don't worry. I'm just going to make a lot of noise," I said. I went out on the porch, despite her protestations. Out on the ledge of the stairway, I growled, shook, and banged my weapon and said threatening words. If I didn't scare the bear, I'm pretty sure that at least the neighbors were a little concerned. Then I returned to my side of the window. We retrieved our bird feeders and took them in the house, and continued to do so for the next week. Barney barked for the next few hours. In my dark thoughts, I considered letting him have a go at the bear. However, despite not getting back to sleep for the rest of the night, I would never do that. He might hurt the bear. Just kidding. The next morning, the neighborhood woke up to destroyed bird feeders, pilfered garbage, and other signs of mayhem. Mr. Bear seems to have departed our environs since then. I guess I really scared him. Now, I can't be sure, but I think some neighbors might be avoiding me. Bio. Leonard Tuchner has Stargardt's disease, which was first noticed during his teenage years. He is now 79. He reads through the media of Braille, recordings, and electronic voices produced by Open Book and Zoom Text. He lives with his wife of 39 years and their two dogs. He is active in the local writing community, which includes attending critique groups. He also facilitates a Writing for Healing and Growth group at the Charlottesville Senior Center and wrote a column for Dialogue magazine. He recently published a poetry book through Cedar Creek Publishing. His hobbies include Tai Chi and...
This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, The Bourne Identity.
He has the skills...
You! Stop right there!
...of a dangerous man.
I need to know what went wrong.
I think he snapped.
But he has no memory.
If we don't take care of this, we will both burn.
He's trained. Conditioned. Built to disappear.
I'll give you $10,000 to drive me to Paris.
I get the money, and I don't get hurt.
That's the deal.
Now, the government's top agent.
I can't remember anything that happened before 2 weeks ago.
Amnesia?
Yes.
Is about to become their number one target.
What's in Paris?
It's a name. Jason Bourne.
Let's see if the Paris police can find him for us.
And the only way he can survive...
Talk a lot.
...is to find out who he is.
I guess you're not home.
Monsieur Bourne!
I don't recognize any of this.
Before they find out...
Get the address!
I think I got it.
In his.
...where he is. Based on the international bestseller...
I don't want to know who I am anymore.
...from Universal Pictures...
You gotta get as far away from me as you can.
What are you gonna do?
Danger.
I have everything to put inside me.
Is
everything I ever learned. All of it.
The Bourne Identity, audio described, starring Matt Damon, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 47 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
The Clock Strikes 12. Written by Patricia Wentworth. Performed by Diana Bishop.
Chapter 41. Polly opened the door of Miss Paradine's sitting room and saw her at the writing table. Without turning her head, Grace Paradine said, "Is that you, Louisa?"
"No, ma'am, it's me."
"Where is Louisa?"
"She's not very well, ma'am."
Miss Paradine sat with a pen in her hand, but she had not been writing. The nib was dry and the sheet in front of her blank. She said in an abstracted voice, "Oh, yes, I forgot." And then, "Go down and ask Mrs. Ray to come up here to me. If she is in the drawing room, just go to the door and ask if you can speak to her for a moment. Then when she has come out of the room, you can give her my message. Can you remember that?"
"Oh, yes, ma'am."
"Very well." She had not turned her head or looked at Polly. She sat there with the pen in her hand and did not write. Her body was stiff and motionless. Her mind had never been clearer or her will more resolute. Behind it there was an anger like ice. Never in all her life had anyone